morning, and I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to give this talk. So I was asked to talk a little bit about some of the interesting phenomena related to neutron star mergers that we might be able to see with gravitational wave observations in the kilohertz regime. And as a theorist who mostly concentrates on sort of these full nonlinear calculations of general relativity, I really think there's a lot of very interesting dynamics that happen in this regime that, you know, when you go and do the calculation of what the gravitational wave signal will look like and then compare it to the, you know, LIGO noise curve, you get a little bit depressed about the prospects for seeing these anytime soon. So I'm very excited to hear about all the, you know, sort of brilliant ideas in this workshop that people have for actually building a detector optimized for this regime. So I chose this kind of musical motif for the title of my talk, in the high notes. So you know, it's common to make this analogy between gravitational waves and sound waves. And actually, neutron stars fit very nicely into the frequency range of a piano, which goes from a few tens of hertz all the way up to about 400 or 4,000 hertz. And so neutron stars sort of cover this whole range, you know, from the, you know, early in spiral, where we have the neutron stars orbiting each other, getting closer and closer together, you know, moving up through this tens to hundreds of hertz regime. And then the merger and then post-merger oscillations happen in this kilohertz regime of a few kilohertz. As I'll talk about later in the talk, sort of the fundamental mode for neutron star oscillation also sort of occur in this regime. But with the way LIGO and other, you know, current ground-based gravitational wave detectors are designed, you know, we're really not hearing these higher notes. We're missing out on this part of the song for neutron stars. So that's illustrated, of course, in the, you know, first and only neutron star detection so far, this GW170817. And so, of course, this is a very exciting and groundbreaking event that you know, LIGO was able to see the gravitational wave from a neutron star merger for the first time. However, if you look at the spectrogram for the signal, where we have time on the x-axis and frequency on the y-axis, you know, we can see, even by eye, clearly the signal moving up from 50 hertz to higher frequencies as the stars get closer together and orbit faster and faster. And then this chirp signal as the binary goes sort of very rapidly through these higher frequencies. And then around 400 hertz, you know, we no longer really pick out the signal out from the noise, and it sort of disappears. And that's not because, you know, this system stopped emitting gravitational waves. This is actually sort of the most violent and strong field part of the merger, but it's because the instrument is not really sensitive to these higher frequencies. So there's a big question mark about what happens in this regime that we'd really like to know. Related to this, you know, in sort of spectacular fashion, the you know, gravitational wave signal from the binary neutron star event was also followed by a whole host of electromagnetic transients. You know, perhaps most importantly, you know, coming from the same part of the sky and following about 1.7 seconds later, we saw a short gamma ray burst. And the spatial and temporal coincidence of these two signals, you know, gave us very high confidence that in fact they were coming from the same source and that binary neutron stars are at least a, if not the, short gamma ray burst engine. And of course, following the short gamma ray burst, we saw a whole host of other electromagnetic transients also associated with this event, you know, in lower frequencies, from X-rays all the way down to radio. However, of course, in the sort of manner of these big discoveries, it also left open a lot of questions. So we'd really like to understand, you know, how exactly that this short gamma ray burst is coming about. And a lot of related questions to this are, you know, when these two neutron stars came together, did they immediately collapse to a black hole? Do they produce a long-lived remnant, that so-called hypermassive neutron star that, you know, had some dynamics for a while and then eventually collapsed to a black hole? Or did they perhaps even leave a sort of stable remnant, some sort of stable star that lasted for a longer time? And the answer to this question will have important implications for understanding the sort of astrophysics and the gamma ray bursts that follow afterwards. You know, and a related question is, what causes this 1.7 second delay? Is it perhaps related to these time scales to collapse, or is it something else, like, you know, the time you need for a jet to break out or something like that? Another question, also coming from this object, we saw a kilonova, an optical signal that was associated with this very dense neutron material that was ejected and then underwent radioactive decay and produced this optical signal. And important in understanding this kilonova signal is understanding sort of how much of this neutron star material was ejected dynamically in the Violence-Le merger, or how much of it came from, you know, an accretion disk that developed a wind and then was subsequently ejected afterwards. So again, you know, important information about that could be gleaned from this high frequency gravitational waves right around the merger. But so far, that signal is sort of buried in the noise. So, you know, kind of in this current age of multi-messenger astronomy, we're getting to see the opening credits of the movie. We know that there are, you know, sort of when and where the main action is taking place, who the main characters are. We know that there are two neutron stars with these masses. They're in spiraling towards each other. But then we sort of, you know, the screen goes dark and we miss an important part of the movie. And then the screen jumps back in right at the big explosion at the end. So we really like to fill in that gap and get more of the details to connect the gravitational waves to the electromagnetic transients. So there are a number of reasons to go after these high-frequency neutron star dynamics. As I just mentioned, it'll help make a better connection to understanding these electromagnetic transients, you know, that go all the way from the short gamma ray bursts to the X-rays to these optical kilonova and radio waves. Another reason is that it allows us to probe general relativity in the strong field regime. That's particular in the regime where space-time is not only strongly curved, but highly dynamical. And this will allow us to test our understanding of GR in this regime, and in particular in the case where we have, you know, non-vacuum space-times, you know, which some beyond GR theories, in particular have predict that you would get the same behavior in general relativity in vacuum space-times, but might get some different behavior in the presence of matter. So I'll mention a little bit about that at the end of my talk. This high-frequency regime of gravitational waves is also sensitive to some subleading effects, like the presence of neutron star spin or things like that. I won't talk a whole lot in my talk about black hole neutron star mergers, but for a black hole neutron star merger, you have the possibility of the neutron star either getting tidally disrupted before it sort of collides with the black hole, or being swallowed whole by the black hole. And which of those two outcomes happen will again be encoded in sort of the very late stages of the merger at higher frequencies. And then perhaps most importantly, this high frequency part of the gravitational wave signal encodes important information about the, you know, unknown nuclear equation of state that governs this very high density material inside a neutron star. Sort of the high frequency part of the gravitational waves that are no longer mainly picking up sort of the point particle nature of the neutron star, but actually picking up the matter effects. So before going into talking in detail about these high frequency dynamics of neutron stars, just as a point of comparison, we should remind ourselves about what sort of the low frequency matter effects that one can see in the N-spiral. So during the N-spiral, sort of the main effect of having a neutron star as opposed to a black hole is basically that the neutron star's companion can tidally deform it slightly and induce a quadrupole in the neutron star. And this will be sort of an extra source of gravitational waves that will cause the orbit to shrink faster. There'll be a slightly faster evolution in the phase of the gravitational wave signal. And so the leading order effect of this is actually encoded in this effective tidal deformability primer, which actually enters as a quite high post-Newtonian correction. So it's what's called a fifth post-Newtonian order effect, which means that it's proportional to the velocity over the speed of light to the 10th power. And so this tidal deformability parameter for a binary is basically this combination here between the tidal deformability parameter of the individual neutron stars 1 and 2, sort of weighted by their mass ratio in this particular way. And this tidal deformability parameter lambda is basically proportional to what's called the Love number, which is basically just the ratio of if you have an external tidal field that you perturb a star with, what the induced quadrupole that star is. And then it's weighted by this ratio of the radius to the mass to the fifth power. So LIGO with this first GW1708-17 event wasn't actually able to measure this tidal deformity parameter, but they were able to put sort of upper bounds on this. So that's what this plot shows here. We have tidal deformability on the x-axis and then some probability distribution here. So you can see that if you assume a particular equation of state, then you get these sort of peaks at various values. So if you were able to measure this, that would tell you a lot about the equation of state. But right now, we sort of have this very broad probability distribution that extends all the way to zero, which would correspond to a black hole. So this effect is also somewhat degenerate with mass ratio and spin of the binary. And there are also actually some sort of more theoretical work that has to be done if we actually want to claim a measurement of this. And that's because we don't actually know all the fifth post-Newtonian order corrections to the waveform. So this is one effect, but we haven't sort of written down all the other ones. And the basic argument why this might be the sort of most important one is because it comes in sort of enhanced by this ratio of the radius to mass, which for a neutron star, the radius in these geometric units is a factor of a few larger than the mass. So we expect maybe this will be a large number and will be the dominant sort of correction. However, the observations are beginning to suggest that this tidal deformity parameter might actually be lower than some of these equations of state would suggest.
For lambda tilde equals to 200, what would be the frequency of the two-tone mode?
So like for this effect, basically, what you're seeing is just that there's the normal orbital frequency, right? And then the sort of evolution of the phase is happening slightly faster as opposed to having a black hole. But you're asking about what the like F mode is of that star or something, or?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume that the smaller the lambda tilde is, the higher the mode frequency.
But the way you're measuring this is not sort of the oscillations of the star. It's just the sort of fact that the phase evolves slightly faster. So basically, it's orbiting slightly faster than it would be if there were black holes instead of the neutron stars. So basically, the lower you make this, the less easily the star is deformed by its companion. And so the smaller the sort of quadrupole you get and sort of the smaller the extra amount of gravitational waves as you radiate. So this is just sort of all the physics you get out. That's sort of the orbital frequency, basically, by seeing how fast it scans through these frequencies. So now let's talk a little bit, for this plot right here, this is actually made assuming that you have two neutron stars and they're governed by the same equation of state. But if we want to sort of play devil's advocate, we could ask, how do we even know that we have two neutron stars as opposed to having a black hole in a neutron star? Of course, it's natural to assume if we see a compact object, whose mass lies somewhere between one and two solar masses, that it's a neutron star because we've observed neutron stars in those mass ranges, and we've never seen a black hole with that mass. However, if you want to sort of revisit these astrophysical assumptions, which may be biased by your observations, and imagine some more exotic scenario where you have primordial black holes or neutron stars are induced to collapse at lower masses during supernova or through some other interactions. You can ask, can we actually rule out a population of exotic low mass black holes sort of in the same mass range as neutron stars from the gravitational waves? So that's something that Juan and I and Louise Lehner considered recently. And it actually turns out that it's quite difficult to rule out this scenario. And that's because this leading order tidal effects, which are encoded in this parameter lambda tilde, which is sort of the combination of the individual stars' tidal deformability, is actually degenerate with our lack of knowledge of the equation of state. So basically, you can get the same leading order tidal effects in a black hole neutron star as in a binary neutron star, basically just by replacing one neutron star with a black hole and then making the other neutron star slightly bigger so that it has a larger tidal deformability. And so that's what's illustrated in this plot here, where basically it's showing that for sort of the range of tidal deformability parameters that we're talking about, you really only have to increase the neutron star by a kilometer or two in radius to sort of absorb the effect of having a black hole neutron star as opposed to a binary neutron star. And of course, so far, we haven't actually been able to measure this tidal deformability parameter yet. Of course, the merger dynamics of a black hole neutron star versus a binary neutron star would be completely different, but those, of course, are at higher frequencies that we're not seeing yet.
Do you have any trouble making the electromagnetic counterpart if you assume a neutron star black hole merger?
That's a good question, and I think we can't really answer it quite yet, mainly because people haven't studied sort of the amount of accretion, the amount of matter left over once you have a black hole neutron star merger. But definitely in the broad strokes, at those mass ratios, you would probably expect the star to get disrupted and form some accretion disk. So you could still, get some ejected material power, have some jet that you might be able to launch and so forth. So I think in the details, there might be differences, but in the broad strokes, there will be matter around that could power one of these transients. Yeah, so now let's talk some about this sort of high frequency dynamics of neutron stars. So if you just take an isolated neutron star and perturb it, sort of the most important density perturbation is the so-called fundamental oscillation, or F mode. And this occurs, these F mode oscillations occur about the 2 to 3 kilohertz frequency range. And so as you can see in this plot here, the exact frequency of the F mode oscillations actually is related to the equation of state. Basically, it's roughly proportional to the average density of the star. And so if you can measure this frequency, you basically be able to tell the equation of state if you combine that with the measurement of the mass. So these F-mode oscillations can actually be excited during the n-spiral if you consider eccentric mergers, that is some orbit that has some non-negligible orbital eccentricity. In that case, as the star makes a path of closest approach, it actually as sort of an impulsive tidal excitation. So you can see the sort of resulting gravitational wave signal here in this plot from Gold et al, where you have this burst of gravitational radiation each time star undergoes a close encounter. And then you have these higher frequency oscillations, which occur at this F mode frequency in between. And so this is the F mode sort of gradually decaying due to gravitational wave emission.
What's the y-axis on the top one?
What's the units you mean?
Or how much strain does it?
Yeah, so I'll give some more details about the strain. So this is in dimensionless units, and it's 10 to the minus 3 in geometric units. But I don't know what the, yeah. So I'll give you some, I'll go into some more details about how detectable. But yeah, and basically this is, like these oscillations are quite small compared to the, compared to the orbit or so forth.
Smaller than small.
Huh?
Small squared.
Yeah, so I'll mention some details about this in a few slides.
Can I ask a question about how these get excited? So the F mode frequency is many kilohertz, I guess, right?
Yeah.
The time scale of, naively, the time scale of, you know, of the close approach from an eccentric orbit, I would think would be much longer than the one over the frequency of the F modes. Is there an intuitive way? I know this is a thing, but is there an intuitive way of understanding how they get rung up?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's why the reason you see them in sort of these eccentric encounters as opposed to the end spiral is basically because, you know, right around this closest approach, you're sort of going from, you know, acceleration to deacceleration. And so you sort of have this more impulsive thing that, you know, its primary component is at lower frequencies.
So broadband, though.
It leaks over, exactly. And so you can sort of see this in this frequency here, that you know, when you go through the burst, it's at lower frequencies. And then when you look at the F mode oscillations, they're at higher frequencies. Yeah.
So this means that the eccentricity also needs to be very high, like 0.9, 0.99. Is that right? To excite these modes?
No, I mean, I think you still see it at moderate. I mean, it definitely diminishes as the eccentricity does, but I mean, just by some, you know, factor of a few or something, if you're at 0.5 or something like that. I mean, definitely if it's 10 to the minus 3, then no, you won't see anything.
If you saw, there's this paper from Lisa Randall earlier this year about high eccentricity binaries after three body interaction. And so.
That wasn't for black holes, however, is that right?
Yeah, but whatever. It's just things, spinning things. But I think the point is in the globular clusters, you could end up with these high eccentricity things, and the eccentricity would last into the hundreds of hertz at least, because the capture happens.
Yeah.
It's a very close capture.
Yeah, so that's basically my next slide. So do we think of the canonical compact object mergers as being very low eccentricity? That's because we sort of think of the primary sources for LIGO and most other and other gravitational wave detectors as being these primordial binaries. We have sort of stars that are already in bound systems that then collapse to form black holes and neutron stars. And because they form very wide separations and gravitational waves are sort of very efficient at getting rid of orbital eccentricity and circularizing these things, you know, basically expect these to have, you know, completely negligible eccentricity by the time they sort of enter the gravitational wave band. However, you can also imagine a different source of gravitational waves coming from compact object mergers that are sort of dynamically assembled in dense stellar regions, such as globular clusters or the cusps of galactic nuclei. And a sort of a subset of these will form at smaller separations and then might merge with non-negligible orbital eccentricity. And you know, the event rates of these are really not that well understood, you know, even compared to sort of the standard LIGO sources. Some estimates put these as, you know, may provide a few sources that LIGO might see, but again, they're sort of very uncertain. There's a lot of ongoing work to sort of understand the dynamics of these systems and clusters, where you sort of have lots of in-body interactions. And, you know, for example, you can form these three-body systems, like was just mentioned, where you have some, you know, quasi resonance or other thing that can drive, you know, over a tertiary that drives the binary to high eccentricities or things like that. So this may be a pretty rare event, but it's something interesting to consider, and definitely sort of one of the smoking guns of these eccentric mergers is these F-mode oscillations. So just to give you, so I can see that, but you can't. Okay. Not quite sure what's happening, so it's showing up on my screen, but not on the projector.
I think videos in Beamer is like one of those LIGO 4 style technologies.
Yeah, it usually works. I don't know why it's not working.
You can just show
it. I've heard rumors about it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, I think the real problem is that Adobe doesn't really like to support them.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can see this, but yeah, so the basic idea is just to show that during these close encounters, so this is a rather extreme case, you can basically excite these tidal F modes, and then they persist basically as the stars move out on these long eccentric orbits. And then they very slowly decay due to gravitational waves, and then you can come back and have subsequent encounters until they finally merge. And this whole time they're sort of emitting gravitational waves in this narrow frequency range that's set by the F mode.
I have seen you play that video before. I can testify.
It's happened.
Yes.
Do you see the F?
It's a cool one.
The gravitational waves from the F modes themselves, or are you seeing the change in the in spiral and merger from,
right,
from the excitation of the F modes?
Right. So it's sort of both of those, right? It might actually be easier to see the former, right? Just the fact that the orbit will sort of happen faster because you're losing energy both to the gravitational waves during the flyby and from putting energy from the orbit into these tidal excitations. For very close encounters, they can actually be comparable, so they're sort of important to take into account both. But at wider separations, it'll predominantly be the energy lost due to the gravitational wave burst. Let's try this one. Hopefully have better luck. All right, see, it does work. So this is sort of a zoom in of these F modes and sort of the co-moving frame with a star. So you can see that it's not actually rigidly rotating, it's more like a pattern speed. So the colors show the density, and these arrows are basically the velocity in this co-moving frame. And the reason they call it an F mode is basically it doesn't have any radial nodes. In some recent work, Kwan and a group of us have tried to come up with sort of a model of the energy that's put into these tidal excitations. So this shows some results from that. Basically shows you the ratio of the energy that's put into these tidal excitations, the ratio of that to the amount of energy that's just emitted in this gravitational waves from the orbit right around periaps. And what you can see is that, for low frequencies, which corresponds to wide separations, it's a sort of a small percentage, but as you approach closer and closer, it can actually become comparable to the burst from gravitational radiation. So if you want to actually model the orbits of these systems, it's important to take into account these tidal effects. And of course, once you put all this energy in the mode on sort of longer time scales, it'll be emitted into gravitational waves at this F mode frequency. And so here's some estimate of the SNR. So this is not actually for LIGO. This is for one of these proposed kilohertz detectors that Juan was thinking about. Here you can see that's because the frequency is sort of around 2 kilohertz. But here, if you start to get in the regime where the energy in this mode is comparable to the burst gravitational regime, you might be able to talk about tens of megaparsecs for seeing these systems. Or you could think about sort of fancier detection strategies where you try to sort of add up gravitational wave signals in this narrow frequency regime over many orbits.
Does this assume that none of the energy in the modes is dissipated as heat?
Yeah. Which I think is somewhat reasonable as a first approximation. Yeah, this is basically just assuming all the energy in the tidal mode goes to gravitational wave.
Can I ask the energy in the EGW? That's the instantaneous energy which is emitted by one orbit, which is essentially just the periaps.
Yeah, exactly.
And does it mean that if you had a black hole neutron star system,
mm-hmm.
and it's an eccentric orbit?
Yeah, you would get similar type effects.
The black hole would excite.
Yeah.
These modes as well.
Yeah.
The neutron star.
Exactly.
Another question. So you showed this movie, and I imagine you have a lot of mass loss during these encounters and afterwards. So is this a problem that you, when you model the InSpiral, for instance, or also if you connect with the F-node, that you possibly do not know the mass of the components because you had such a substantial mass loss? Or what is the?
I mean, I don't think there's much mass loss, except maybe at the very, very last stages. Yeah.
But not before.
Yeah. Yeah, so now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about what happens after merger. So here's an animation of two neutron stars merging. You can see that there's a lot of sort of complicated dynamics and oscillations going on as these two things smash together. So actually, in this particular case, there's sort of an under density in the middle here, and the star over many sort of oscillations begins to develop this funny wobble, which is actually called a one-arm mode instability. So, and this one-arm mode instability can actually persist for many, many oscillations. So I'll talk about this in some detail in a few slides. But so first of all, here's the corresponding gravitational wave signal from such an event. So you can see the strain. And the thing to note is that while the neutron star is undergoing all these complicated oscillations, you get corresponding gravitational waves that are happening. And there's this complicated signal.
Your strain 10 to the minus 21 means what's the distance of the source here?
I think here we chose like 50 megaparsecs or something.
50.
But I mean, it's not really, the point here is not.
No, it's just to scale in my head the order of magnitude for the strain.
Yeah. But here I just wanted to mainly focus on the fact that, in comparison to a black hole, where the post-merger signal exponentially decays and is sort of essentially gone after a few oscillations. So these post-merger neutron stars, you have this potentially very long-lived signal. In principle, a lot of information about the neutron star's equation of state in the signal. However, as you can see from the scale, it's occurring at a frequency of a few kilohertz, where it'd be very hard to see this with LIGO. In this post-merger remnant, which we call a hypermassive neutron star, in the case that it's sort of above maximum mass for a cold, non-rotating neutron star, so we expect it to eventually collapse to a black hole. There's potentially a lot of important information in there. First and foremost, just knowing whether or not there were a signal like this would tell you that you didn't actually promptly collapse to a black hole, which is definitely another possibility depending on the equation of state, but you had one of these hypermassive neutron stars. In addition, this is sort of, in contrast to these F-mode oscillations where you have sort of a cold neutron star that's slightly tightly perturbed, this is actually probing this very hot, very perturbed, differentially rotating, extremely high density material that you get in these post-merger remnants. Even if we could sort of, get some handle on the tidal effects of the InSpiral, this would allow us to sort of study the neutron star equation of state in a different, higher density, higher temperature regime. Here are some examples of sort of the post-merger gravitational wave signals from some work by Rizzola and Pakami. You can see that these are for sort of three different equations of state. So you get sort of peaks at different frequencies depending on the equation of state. So we're sort of talking about the, you know, 1 to 3 kilohertz regime. And these frequencies, you know, can actually be mapped very well onto the equation of state. So I think Andreas will talk in detail about this in his talk. Some of these peaks are sort of coming from, are sort of relatively short-lived. They're just coming from the two neutron stars sort of settling down to a final neutron star. But in some cases, you can actually have a post-merger gravitational wave signal that actually persists for a long time, like hundreds of milliseconds or more, like in the case of this one-arm instability that I mentioned. So I want to talk a little bit in detail about that. So this one-arm spiral instability in neutron stars is actually an instability in differentially rotating stars. So it was actually first discovered in the context of Newtonian simulations of polytropic stars that had large differential rotation. And it was also seen to occur in the cores that you form from a core collapse supernova. However, it was only in some recent work that I did with Vasilis Paskoulis and some other collaborators that we actually saw this occurring in the hypermassive neutron star that you can get post-merger. So we originally found this in the context of these eccentric mergers, but this eccentricity isn't really important, and they also occur in quasi-circular mergers with a sort of comparable strength and signal, as was shown in some subsequent work by Radice and Lehner et al. So I think sort of one of the interesting lessons of this is that, you know, we're still sort of resolving the small scale physics, and, you know, things that depend on like turbulence and other things like that. You know, there's still a lot of theoretical work to understand these systems, and probably still some surprises in these. So I'll return to that point a little later. So here again, I'm showing you the density on the left, and on the right, I'm showing you the vorticity as these two things come together. So you can see that, maybe I'll
start that again.
So you can see the density, vorticity, these two stars as they merge. You can see as they merge, you get this sort of vortex sheet when they come into contact. You get these two vortices that eventually spiral towards the center. And that's associated with the under density here. And then as the star oscillates, eventually this vortex becomes displaced from the center. And then this star begins to develop this funny one-arm wobble.
Is there an anti-vortex? So I see this blue stuff and the red stuff. Is the red stuff anti-vortex?
Yeah. Yeah, and so you can also see the formation of this one-arm mode in the rotation profile. So this just shows the angular frequency as a function of the radius averaged over the sort of phi direction for one case, but showing various times. So this blue curve corresponds to before this one-arm mode is set in, and then moving to later times, you can see basically that the star settles down to having this region of radius that's basically almost rigidly rotating. The angular frequency is sort of constant as a function of radius, and then it's higher at the core and then lower at the sort of tails. And this dotted dashed line corresponds to the sort of fundamental frequency of this one-arm mode. So initially, you can see there is a co-rotation radius where it crosses this frequency, and that causes it to flatten out. So you can also see this if you sort of do a decomposition of the density of the star into these different azimuthal modes. So that these different curves correspond to the m equals 1, that's the blue curve, m equals 2 is the red curve, m equals 3 is the black curve, and m equals 4 mode, which is the green curve. So you can see initially you're dominated by the m equals 2 azimuthal mode. If you look at the density, because you have two stars and they're coming together. But as the merger happens, this sort of dies down. And initially, there's essentially no M equals one mode because this is an equal mass system. So it has this pi reflection symmetry. But as the stars come into contact, this mode gradually increases, and then it persists basically for as long as we're able to run these kinds of simulations. And then on the right-hand side, I'm showing you the corresponding gravitational waves. So you can see that there's this 2-2 mode, which we can associate with this M equals 2 mode. And then there's also, you develop a L equals 2, M equals 1 component to the gravitational wave signal, which you can associate with this M equals 1 mode. And that sort of ramps up during the merger and then sort of persists at relatively constant amplitude. So whether or not you have this one-arm mode instability also depends on the equation of state. So here I'm showing you several different equations of state, ranging from a soft equation of state, which means you get smaller neutron star for a given mass, that's the black curve, going to a stiffer equation of state, and the stiffest one is the red curve. And so that means you give the largest radius for a given mass. And so this shows you the M equals 1 density component, this shows you the M equals 2 density component. So you can see that there's a tendency for the soft equations of state, you very clearly develop these M equals 1 modes, while for the stiffer equations of state, in some cases they die down rapidly and you're still dominated by these M equals 2 sort of bar mode oscillations of the star. So here's a kind of extreme case with a very stiff equation of state. We actually form this sort of double core system that's initially supported by the very strong pressure. But then again, after many oscillations, there is sort of the development of this M equals 1 mode as one of these cores becomes higher density compared to the other.
Is an equation of state this stiff already ruled out by tidal measurements from 1717?
Yeah, I think for this particular one, it would no longer be. Yeah. Yeah, and so even for these stiff equations of state, like in this case, if you consider basically some stars that have a disparate mass ratio, so this is a mass ratio of 0.9. That gives you an initial sort of M equals 1 perturbation to your system. In those cases, you can still even see this M equals 1 mode dominate after long enough times. And so here we're going to something like 60 milliseconds. Here I'm showing you sort of the spectrum of the gravitational waves just from this post-merger. So this is basically just 10 milliseconds of the post-merger signal after these initial sort of bar mode oscillations have died out. And these different curves just correspond to the different equations of state. So you can again see that basically if you were able to measure this gravitational wave signal, just sort of knowing the frequency would tell you a lot about the equation of state. And you get these sort of resonances basically correspond to M equals 1, M equals 2, M equals 3, and so on. And though sort of the dominant one is this M equals 2, having this M equals 1 perturbation of the system actually shifts the frequency to lower frequencies of around a kilohertz. Depending on the design of your detector, that might actually be more detectable. And so this is for an integration time of 10 milliseconds, but that's not because they sort of die out on the time scales. If you sort of run these things longer and integrate more, basically these peaks keep on increasing because they're roughly a constant amplitude. So this is showing these blue curves are sort of 40 milliseconds versus 10 milliseconds for the black curves. And if you just do some naive estimate of how long these signals might last, just by looking at how fast they're emitting angular momentum compared to the total angular momentum system, you can get estimates of something up to a second. And of course, on these timescales, you'd worry about other physics like magnetic fields or neutrino cooling or things like that. So that's definitely not really sure what happens on such long timescales, but eventually be quite long-lived. And then you can see, for example, this just for this particular case, this LIGO high frequency configuration happens to fit right at the peak frequency of this first n equals one. So estimates of the signal to noise ratio, just for LIGO, you're getting something like distances of 10 megaparsecs or something like that. So you have to hope for a relatively closed system to be able to see this. If you have some sort of more complicated data analysis technique, like combining sort of stacking noise from multiple observations or something, you might be able to reduce the threshold. If you see this, you probably definitely saw the end spiral, so maybe that can also be leveraged to sort of decrease the threshold for detecting these systems. And then, of course, if the integration time increases, optimistically, these things may last up to a second. That would also increase the size of these systems. But of course, you really would like something that goes after these sort of 1.5 to 2 kilohertz regime for the signal. So just a little bit before I close, I want to mention that though there's been a lot of progress in understanding the dynamics of hypermassive neutron stars, there's many groups who've worked on this, many more than I list here. I think there's still a lot of work to do. And if we start talking about building a kilohertz gravitational wave detector, there will really sort of be a challenge to the theorist to sort of understand all the physics that happens in this regime. That's in particular because not only are these systems governed by sort of gravity and hydrodynamics, but they also sort of depend on this hot equation of state. There's magnetic fields play an important role, radiation transport, cooling through neutrinos. And so not only do we have to include all this physics, we also have to resolve sort of the length scales, the extra length scales that these things introduce into our system. And this is hard, in particular, since a lot of these systems can actually become turbulent in the sense that they transfer energy to smaller and smaller scales. So turbulence is hard. So this is kind of illustrated by this plot from Cucci et al. And so what they're looking at here is you have a magnetized neutron star, you create a hypermassive neutron star, you create a merger, and it's subject to this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And what they're plotting is the energy and the magnetic field as a function of the wave number k. And these different colors just correspond to different numerical resolutions. If the blue curve is the lowest resolution and the red curve is the highest resolution. So you basically see as they're increasing the resolution, they're not only getting more energy at small scales, they're also just getting more energy at all scales. And the resolution they're using here is actually quite extreme. It's much more than what is typically used for these systems, but they're only sort of beginning to resolve these kinds of effects. I think there's definitely room for a lot more work to be done and for sort of more surprises in these systems, where I think in general, under-resolving these things tends to artificially dissipate them and sort of wash out these effects. So just briefly before I end, so far I've been concentrating on just the dynamics of neutron stars in general relativity. However, we can also consider some more exotic scenarios where we might have some alternative theories to general relativity. And for example, there are scalar tensor theories that basically predict the same behavior for gravity around black holes when you just have vacuum, but will give you a different behavior when you have matter around. And in some of these cases, actually, these differences will only show up at high frequencies. So this is a plot from Barassi et al, where they consider this particular scalar tensor theory and considered a neutron star merger. And these different curves just correspond to different values of one of these parameters that basically encodes your deviations from GR. So the black curve would be the GR curve. And basically, at larger separations or lower frequencies, these neutron stars behave the same. And then at some smaller separation, depending on the value of this parameter, they basically, these stars become spontaneously scalarized. They develop this scalar charge, which basically causes the merger to happen faster compared to in general relativity. And so that's what's happening here. In addition, you know, we can also consider the possibility of having other exotic compact objects that have sort of an overlapping mass range with neutron stars, like low mass black holes I mentioned, or things like boson stars. And so in order to rule out those things or you know, potentially go look for them, we really want to be able to see this late stages of the merger in the high frequency regime. Yeah, so I'll just conclude there and say that, at least in my opinion, I think the most interesting dynamic of neutron star mergers really occur in this high frequency regime of gravitational waves. So I'm excited to hear about all the exciting ideas for detecting this. So you can, you know, do things like probe perturbations of equilibrium stars if there are some non-negligible number of these eccentric mergers. You can uncover these highly dynamical oscillations of hypermassive neutron stars. And I think there's a lot of room for sort of new discoveries and surprises in this regime. And, you know, in order to go at this, you know, not only do we need, you know, breakthroughs in the experimental work, I think we'll also need breakthroughs in the theoretical side. So thank you.
Maybe a little bit at the side question, but is there anything you could learn from the stochastic background, from the astrophysical background of neutron stars at high frequencies? So provided that such detectors would exist, you would need two co-located detectors and very sensitive. And so if you could see the kind of averaged peak throughout the universe, including its redshift kind of, is there anybody thinking about this, or is there anything to learn you could not learn from individual detections?
Yeah, so I don't really know any of the details of that. Maybe someone else does, but I do think that, I mean, there's a lot of these signals that were sort of the frequency is set by, you know, microphysics as opposed to, you know, the being that sensitive to the particular parameters of the binary or something like that. So you could definitely imagine that, you know, that might be a worthwhile detection strategy, is to basically, you know, look for you know, a whole population of these systems that are undergoing merger and oscillating at a near the same frequencies, and adding up all that gravitational wave signal as opposed to just looking for one event. You know, same thing with the F modes, you know, it's sort of, you're exciting it with different frequencies, but then it oscillates at sort of this one frequency that's set by the microphysics. So I don't really know how much better or worse you would do compared to observing particular events, but I definitely think it's something that's worth looking into. I don't know if anyone else wants to say something about that.
Well, yeah, I think at high frequencies, indeed, this post-merger emission on hypermassive neutron stars give you the dominant stochastic gravitational wave background above kilohertz. And this background depends on the equilibrium state. So for different equilibrium state, magnitude of the background is different. It's kind of difficult to detect this background, though. You need very high, very sensitive detector, and also you want to, as you said, you want to have a co-located detector to do this kind of correlation. so if there is no more question, let's thank Will again.